Welcome to the People's Historians podcast with the Zen Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools. I'm Jesse Hagopian, a co-editor of Rethinking Schools and host of this series on Teach the Black Freedom Struggle. And today, I'm talking with project co-founder and historian Jean Theo Harris about Rosa Parks's activism prior to the Montgomery bus boycott, her trip to the Highlander Folk School, and the decades she dedicated to challenging racism in the North. So let's jump in. I am very happy to welcome Jean Theo Harris, the author or co-author of 11 books and numerous articles on the civil rights and Black power movement and contemporary politics of race in the United States, including the award-winning titles, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, and a book that I would highly recommend that you all order as well, A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. So, welcome, Jean. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for being here. This is so fun.
Isn't it?
I'm so excited.
It does blow my mind to think about when you first contacted me about the YA edition of this book. And we were like, oh, what an amazing idea. And then to see this film get made on top of it.
I know. And to get to share it with everyone tonight. And we got to build all these lessons about it. And it just feels like it just grows and grows and grows.
It really does.
When we started this series, right? There was no film. There was no even possibility for the film when we started this series. Jesse and I did the first one of this series together about Rosa Parks before there was even a possibility of a documentary film.
That's right. And now we have lesson plans and a documentary. And awesome. I just want to say congratulations to you. You've put your life's work into this and it really shows. And it's such a magnificent film and book. And I just get so excited thinking about the impact it's going to have. So thank you.
Thank you.
So I'll let everyone know that throughout the session, we will be showing clips from the brand new film, and teachers can access a streaming license to show the film in their classroom. And so we'll drop the form to that in the chat that you can fill out. I highly recommend everyone show this in their classroom. So we're going to begin with the opening clip of this film. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Yeah, that's how it gets launched. I love the opening to this film. That moment where he says, "Will the real Rosa Parks please stand up?" I just feel like it's so symbolic. Really, it says a lot about what people don't know. And so I was hoping you could talk more about that. Why is it that so few people know the real Mrs. Parks? And when they learn who the real Mrs. Parks is, how will they see her and see our nation differently, Jean?
Right. I mean, I was so glad that they used, I discovered that clip when I was working on the book, and I always had this fantasy that like we would use it in a film or, you know, or a theater production, because it's like watching a train wreck, right? Because it's like it's like Rosa Parks cosplay, for one. So you have all these different like stereotypes of Black women. Obviously, the person who's playing the middle class Black woman with pearls is who wins, right? Who gets the most votes. So you have that. So the like the idea of Rosa Parks wins. Mm-hmm. And for people, this game show, you won money based on being able to fool the judges, right? So that was the whole shtick of this show. So it says a lot about kind of our idea of who she is versus who she is. So there's the real Rosa Parks. And if we got to watch the full clip of this, Nipsey Russell and her are having this whole detailed conversation, and the other judges still don't even notice, and they still vote for the middle person. And then there's the horribleness of people being like, any of you could have done this, right? And I think that gets to another myth about the way we talk about her, right? Which is this sort of, you kind of stumble into history on one day and just this, it's this sort of American myth, right? That I think are the ways that we are often taught and learn about Rosa Parks, I think misses, and we're going to talk about this a lot tonight, the, you know, the kind of work, the kind of sacrifice, the kind of longevity it takes to actually change history. And then on the one hand, Rosa Parks does show the power of all of us. And on the other hand, like she's tremendously extraordinary. Most of us, almost none of us could have done what she did, right? And so you have all of those panelists and judges being like, oh yeah, any of you could have done it. And so it's such to me a way into really the kind of harmfulness of the ways that we've talked about her. I could never document this, but I think she goes on the show because she also needs money and is willing to go on the show. This it shows in 1980. Hmm. And I mean, I think one of the places we wanted to start tonight was, I think one of your and my favorite ways of teaching her, which is that it really opens up an opportunity for critical thinking. And as you started off by saying, Jesse, we built a set of lessons around the film and around the young adult book. And one of the lessons that you built was a lesson about thinking about the master narratives we get about Rosa Parks. And I think part of the opening kind of does it in a playful way to kind of get us to have a conversation with students about kind of the ways you've learned or the kind of information you've received about Rosa Parks. And then what is it going to mean to change that? And I think to change that, I think students really are ready for that conversation. To change Rosa Parks means changing how we understand how social change happens, how we understand movements, not individuals, how we understand the sacrifice it takes, how we understand the whole variety of injustice that people were fighting for. I think sometimes the civil rights movement gets trapped in this like little box of like bus segregation. And so we're going to get to hear her tonight and in the full movie and in the book, all of the different issues that they're working on. And the bus is sort of a symbolic space because it's a very palpable space of segregation. But she's very clear that it's not just about, I mean, it's never just about a seat on the bus or about sitting next to a white person. Kind of what we're gonna do tonight, and we're gonna drop some of these links to the lessons in the chat, and of course they will be sent out afterwards so people can play with them and use them in your classes. But what we're gonna do is we're gonna then, like basically Jesse and I are gonna talk a little bit as we've just done, and then now we're gonna show another clip.
Well, there you were just about to explain it, so we can have you live explaining it. But I'll just quickly preface it by saying I'm curious what Recy Taylor's case tells us about who Rosa Parks was and about really Black women's experience in the U.S. more broadly. Both the way white supremacy is specifically wielded against Black women, but also how Black women have organized against that white power. And, you know, how does Recy Taylor's case reverberate throughout history in terms of what you saw with Joanne Little there, or even Marissa Alexander that happened in 2017?
Yeah, thank you. So I think the first thing is to sort of see the Recy Taylor case and her work on it as a kind of microcosm of all of this work she's doing in the 40s and 50s. And I think there's two sides, and it's a lot around what we would call criminal justice issues. And there's sort of two sides of that coin. One is the wrongful incarceration of Black people and particularly Black men. And then the reverse side of that coin is the lack of protection for Black people and particularly Black women from white violence. Over and over in this decade before Rosa Parks' bus stand, she alongside a small group of activists in Montgomery will press for justice in many of these cases. And here we got to see a little bit of one of those cases, which is the case of Mrs. Recy Taylor. And I think it shows both the kind of breadth, as you put it, Jesse, of what the Black freedom struggle is about, right? I think we often focus on buses, lunch counters, and voting. And in fact, there's a whole range of issues that people are fighting on. And again, particularly issues we would call criminal justice issues. And I think the second point that you were highlighting is the ways that people are attending to both kind of racial and gender oppression and the ways that we might say, we might call it the kind of intersectional oppression, right? So racism is working differently towards and on Black women than it is on Black men. And so we see people at the, this is not just a modern way of understanding this, right? People like Rosa Parks understood that as well, right? And so part of that, again, was both fighting around cases like Scottsboro, where Black men were being wrongfully accused of sexual violence, and then the lack of protection for Black women. And so fighting on that as well. And understanding that the kind of this long struggle. So I think part of what I also think we get from this clip and what we take to our students is really working against the ways this is often taught, which is how many things they're fighting on, how much they're losing, and yet they keep fighting, right? So that I think part of what we learn about social change from a kind of longer, bigger history of Rosa Parks is that you have to fight and you have to like lay down a line even when you can't see that it's gonna do what you want it to do. And I think that's a very profound lesson. And so I think somebody had put in the chat, do I like some of these children's books about her? And I do not like them. And the fundamental reason why I do not like them is because they do not show, and I think you can tell a kindergartner or a first grader, I think you don't have to give all the detail, but you can say, she tried to fight this, she tried to fight this, she tried to fight this, they tried to fight this, they tried to fight this. A first grader can understand that idea that you try things and it's not working, and you keep trying them and they're not working. And until we start to teach that version of Rosa Parks and that version of the civil rights movement, right, we aren't telling a kind of truthful story. And so we're actually going to show one more clip before we go to breakout rooms. And that is a clip that gets us to the story we're most familiar with, which is the bus boycott. But I think it shows the bus boycott a little bit differently than the way we're usually given it.
Mrs. Parks is most known for refusing to stand for the bus driver, James F. Blake, when he ordered that she relinquish her seat in the colored section to a white passenger after the whites only section was filled on December 1st, 1955 in Montgomery. And many of us learn this moment. Everybody learns about that moment, right? But what is often mistaught or left out about the Montgomery bus boycott is that, Mrs. Parks' long resistance, long history of resisting helped lead to this moment. I'm also especially interested in the leading role that Black women played in organizing the boycott, even though Martin Luther King career was really launched as an icon of the civil rights movement. A lot of the Black women were organizing it. So hopefully you can tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, so right. This is the most familiar. This is the story we all know, except it's not the story we all know. And again, we have a lesson for this. And I mean, just put it in the chat. And part of what we tried to get at in the lesson is that part of how we often tell and teach the Montgomery bus boycott story is a story of two people. It's a story of Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, and somehow that turns into a boycott. And I think what we can see here, and we only showed like a couple minutes. The boycott section is actually about 15 minutes, and we get to see a lot of different characters, and how it took so many different people to both turn this act into even a one-day boycott, because we want to remember it's a one-day boycott they call for the the Women's Political Council, which is a Black women's group in Montgomery that had been organizing, and we get to see more of that in the documentary if you watch the full thing, had been organizing before this, and they leap into action that night after she's arrested. And Joanne Robinson, who's the head of the Women's Political Council, runs off 35,000 leaflets that say, another woman has been arrested on the bus. It doesn't say Rosa Parks has been arrested on the bus. It says another woman. And that's because what we're seeing is the accumulation of outrage, right? Claudette Colvin had been arrested in March. Mary Louise Smith had been arrested in October. And even before that, there had been a trickle of people, including a trickle of women. So we have the role that women are playing in terms of bus resistance themselves. We have the Women's Political Council, who is who calls that one day boycott. And then I think another lesson in this is the ways that action begets a change in vision. So it's that night when people feel the power of that day that they change this one day boycott into an ongoing boycott. And I think that, again, is a really important thing for students to understand, is that idea that in some sense, being in motion or changes what you can imagine is possible. And then I think the last part of the Montgomery bus boycott story that I think needs to be taught is the ways that it is about an organized Black community. So that how they keep up a year-long boycott, and we get to see this if you watch more of the film, is through this incredible carpool system they build, where they set up 40 pickup stations across Montgomery, and they're giving like 10 to 15,000 rides a day, and people are coordinating this and driving for it. And I think that it's this community, and Black women are fundraising to keep them, because this obviously requires a lot of funds, it requires dispatchers, right? There's all of this organization, and yet the way we tend to sort of be taught the boycott is just somehow it happens, and then the buses are desegregated, right? And it's just like, no. So the work of it, but also, right, the pivotal, all these different roles that women play in it, and yet the ways that in many ways, the only people we learn about are Parks and King, and even Parks and King are put in these very narrow boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the way it's just discussed as spontaneous, as if the Women's Political Council didn't run off thousands of memos and hadn't, been working on these issues for a long time. So thank you for putting that in context. Yeah, thanks for picking that clip, Jean. We often don't think about the real lives of the people who have been canonized and exalted, right? We don't think about their day-to-day life struggles, only the moments that they're famous for, right? And Mrs. Parks had some serious life challenges, struggling to make ends meet. So why is it important that we learn about Mrs. Parks' class position? And why, even after all she did to launch the civil rights movement, was she not taken better care of by her and better supported by her comrades?
So again, I think if we go back to some of the master narrative or the myths we started at the beginning of our conversation, one of the other problems with that myth of like, she sits down, people rise up, things are changed, is that it misses the person of Rosa Parks and the kind of sacrifice it really entails for her and her family. As we saw here, right, she gets fired from her job 5 weeks in, her husband loses his job, they never find steady work again in Montgomery. They leave for Detroit, and then really the suffering continues for many years. So it's a decade of suffering. And I think having to kind of see that also, I think, helps us see, just again, the length and breadth of what it takes in this sort of struggle. I think at the end of the film, Patrice Cullors will say, like, in some ways, the way the master narrative of Rosa Parks and the civil rights movement makes it seem like, fixing racism is easy. And I think that misses both the longness of the struggle, but also the kind of personal sacrifice. And I think part of this is because she's a woman, right? And so the kind of suffering that she is enduring, they sort of assume it's her husband that needs to fix this, I think, in some ways. I think in some ways it's about, you know, it has to do with kind of tensions between groups at the time. I mean, I think there's lots of reasons why she kind of, and then she's really proud. Telling this part of the history was really hard because she wants this period of time in her life. She gets past it. She doesn't like to talk about it. If anybody's read her young adult autobiography, it's really not in there. So again, part of this is also she doesn't like to talk about this. I saw someone in the chat talking about Robert Williams, and just I feel like we need to clarify that. So there is a little bit in the film about Robert Williams and about her links to Black Power. I mean, I think the ways to think about Mrs. Parks and Robert Williams is a couple of things. One is what they're doing in Montgomery and the way they transform Montgomery's NAACP into kind of a more activist group is a little bit what Williams will do that a decade later. And we should also just say, we skipped over this, but the Parks family are part of a long tradition of kind of Black self-defense. And, you know, they always believed in self-defense. She believed in self-defense. Raymond believed in self-defense. They, you know, during the Scottsboro organizing, I mean, he was carrying. Then fast forward to Detroit, where she actually meets Robert Williams, is when he comes back to the United States after he's been in exile. And she's part of the movement to kind of prevent his extradition. And interestingly, one of the things I learned when I was doing interviews was how he, as he's speaking, when he comes back into the United States and he comes back to Michigan, Williams settle in Michigan, is he's also kind of mad that people don't recognize who she is. And so his wife, Mabel Williams, told me that in a lot of speeches when they first get back to the United States, he is saying people need to be recognizing Rosa Parks. So she's both looking out for him and raising money, you know, and doing all these petitions around not extraditing him to North Carolina where he's facing charges. But also he's really, you know, sees her as this kind of hero. I think the story people tend to tell is that she gives a eulogy at his funeral, but I think it misses all of this history they have much before then. And again, there's some of that in the film and some of her ties to Black Power in the film. Unfortunately, like the film is only like an hour and 40 minutes. And so there were so many things that that couldn't fit in.
They got to read the book too.
They do have to, exactly.
Got to do both. Well, we have another clip for them, right?
Yes, we do. We have another clip. I think we are having a clip on, are we going to Detroit?
I think the next one is more about women.
Oh, yeah, about women, right? And the ways that, women are marginalized. Yes.
Awesome. I love that quote from Reverend Joanne Watson when she says, when you go back and check the record, those who have been labeled presidents, directors, leaders, and grand poobahs have largely been men while the women do the work. Right. And then she says, and Mother Parks did the work. So talk about the exclusion of women, the March on Washington, and you know, the role of women in the civil rights movement, and not just the organizing that they definitely did, but also the strategizing and the theorizing of Black women and Mrs. Parks's contributions to that.
Right. So one of the ironies about the exclusion of the women at the March on Washington is how much of the kind of leadership and strategizing women are doing, even in terms of organizing the March on Washington. And I think the other thing we want to be clear about is that women at the time recognized this problem. And so there are women like Ann Arnold Hedgman, like Dorothy Height, like Polly Murray, who are protesting to Randolph, to Rustin, that this is tokenism, this is unfair, that this is treating women like Black people are being treated, you know, like they're making these criticisms at the time. And Mrs. Parks is making this criticism. She talks about saying to one of the other women on the dais that day with her is Daisy Bates, and And she says to Daisy Bates that, you know, and they're talking about how they hope a change is coming, right? That this is, you know, all of this leadership that women have shown, and yet women are really marginalized at the March on Washington. No woman gets to speak. We get to hear the voice of Gloria Richardson in that clip. Gloria Richardson and Lena Horne kind of go off script and are taking Rosa Parks around to kind of some international news stations. And Richardson believes this is why. So they get sent home before even King speaks. They get put in a cab and sent back to the hotel. And Richardson believes that it's because they were kind of going off script because they were taking Parks around. So that's interesting.
Wow.
Gloria Richardson, again, most of us, you know, she's not. We don't tend to learn about Richardson until college at the first. And yet, if we had been living in 1963, she was a household name. The movement she helped to organize in Cambridge, Maryland, it's front page news. She's negotiating with the Kennedys, right? And so, part of the kind of irony of the kind of erasure of women is both it's happening at the time, but also that some of the historical erasures are like really distort how important these women were in the moment.
Yeah.
And I think again, this gets back to what we were talking about before in terms of her suffering, that some of the suffering is also kind of related to this kind of gendered, these gender ideas, so that you're supposed to, part of Rosa, why we're not so familiar with Rosa Parks's ideas is part of that gendered idea of like who does the work and who sits on the, you know, at the pulpit or on the podium. So
Yeah.
yeah, I think we have time for one more clip, right?
Okay, good.
Let's
Good.
do one more, which
Let's
is
do it.
we're gonna look at the Detroit uprising and kind of think about, and similarly, we did a lesson that looks at the uprising and teaching kind of racism and the kind of movement in the North. Because, I mean, one of the things Jesse and I have been talking about this for years, but Rosa Parks really allows you to teach a whole variety of issues that aren't necessarily in the textbook. But for instance, how do you teach about the Black freedom struggle where you are based, right? Like, because it tends to be, you know, Montgomery, you know, maybe Little Rock, maybe
Maybe
Atlanta,
Birmingham.
maybe Selma, right? But what if you're teaching in
Yeah.
Portland, or what if you're teaching in Milwaukee, or what are you teaching in Pittsburgh? And so I think part of what, I mean, this is a specific lesson that focuses on Parks in Detroit, but I think it's also a way into thinking about all of the movements that are happening all over the country because, right, racism and segregation are not just a Southern problem, but a national problem.
What a great clip. And like we were talking before, the way that you can teach about the Black Power movement, something that can be difficult to teach about in today's political climate, but you can enter it through a discussion of Rosa Parks' support for it. I love that idea. But I love the clip of Dan Aldridge saying that he was a young militant helping to organize this People's Tribunal for the police officers who murdered those youth. And he thought that putting police on trial by the community was going to be too radical for Mrs. Parks. And then he asked her, and she says, "Certainly, I'm glad you asked." Right? That like to me sums up the lessons I've learned from Eugene about who Rosa Parks really was, just always ready to take the next step in the freedom struggle. So talk about these Detroit uprisings and Mrs. Parks' reaction and the Black Power movement.
So, I mean, I think part of what I also love about that clip from Dan Aldridge is the ways that she also really loved young people and really loved the militancy of young people and was willing to let young people lead. And I think that's a moment we see in the film where she's like, yeah, I'm coming. If I can be, you know, like, I'm glad you asked. And, you know, when I interviewed him, he said, you know, she was like, if I can be useful, I'll come. You know, like this was sort of her philosophy was not that she had to tell young people what to do, but that she would sort of come and support what they were trying to do. And I think this clip also, and people were putting some stuff in the chat about different places. I think it gets us to, it feels very modern. It feels very much like where we are today. I think it's very useful in terms of showing our students, because I think sometimes Rosa Parks is just put in this distant past, right? Like, you know, she would joke that, and not joke, that people would often ask her if she knew Harriet Tubman. And obviously, yeah. But I think sometimes for our students, in the way that the kind of Black History Month poster is a posterification, right, of Black heroes, right? So somehow it's just they're all in like black and white in the distant past. And then you see something like this and you're like, wait a minute. These are issues we're dealing with today, right? She's sitting on a tribunal because police murdered three Black teenagers, and there's no indictment, and the newspapers stop following up. And that feels very,
Very current.
very current, right? And so using her as a way to talk about these issues today, using her, like all of this activism, to sort of talk about the struggles wherever we are teaching. And again, there's lots of good resources now on so many cities. So we can certainly, in future discussions, if people have those questions, you can let us know and we can recommend more resources.
Yeah.
But just this has been such a fun one, right?
No, it really has. What a great format. What a wonderful group that gathered today. Thanks for joining us today. This podcast is brought to you by the Zen Education Project, coordinated by Teaching for Change and Rethinking Schools.
Music provided by The Blue Tide, a Seattle-based acoustic blues duo of Daniel Rapport and JD Lenore, aka Jesse Hagopian. You can find them on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you get your music.